This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. May Day is coming on Monday. What's going to happen in the Seattle area? Well, how about a, quote, mass peaceful civil disobedience that shuts down highways, airports, and other key infrastructure? That's what Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant is calling for, among other things. That kind of talk is reckless and irresponsible, according to a Washington State Patrol captain. Many of you had something to say about this, too, on KUOW's Facebook page. So let's talk through this. What is May Day for, and what is the right way to do it? Councilmember Shama Sawant, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to tactics, what's your goal? What do you want to accomplish on Monday, May Day?
Well, just to make sure everybody knows, May Day or May 1st is International Workers' Day. And in America, historically, it has also been a day for immigrant rights protests. And it's a day when, more than any other protest, families with children and elderly members will come out on the streets, especially to demand for immigrant rights. And I think that this May Day, it's especially important for us because this is the era of Donald Trump in the White House. So one of the most important messages this May Day will be that we are all going to be peacefully marching and rallying together in solidarity with our immigrant sisters and brothers who are facing ICE raids, detentions and deportations, and the violence of families being ripped apart. So I think that's first and foremost, we need to be there in solidarity with our immigrant sisters and brothers.
You mentioned President Trump, but you've worked on May Day rallies before Trump. Are your goals any different now?
I think the goal for May Day every year is to bring out the voice of the immigrant community and the labor movement and working people in general. So that goal has been the same throughout the years. But I think this year it has a special significance, as I said, because people are so angry against Donald Trump, justifiably so. And everything that we've seen since he took office shows us that he is, first of all, serious about his egregious ideas, but also that we can push back and win. Look at the defeat he had on the Trump care. Look at the defeat on the Muslim travel ban.
One more question on your big picture goal, because for some marchers, May Day is about promoting socialist revolution. For others, the goal is to defend the rights of immigrants and workers within a capitalist economy. What about you?
I think that the goal of fighting for the interests of workers and immigrants within the current system is very much tied to also bringing about a vision for what would a truly just society would look like. So I don't see those two things as separate. And this year, like in the previous years, I personally will be honored to be marching along with the May 1st Action Coalition. This is a united movement that has decided a march route and the plans for the rally itself, where we'll have Aztec dancers and several political speeches from the labor movement and from the immigrant community.
On KUOW's Facebook page, Chrissy writes, "Blocking traffic blocks emergency vehicles. It's rude and selfish. It is not going to get people to side with your cause. March and protest peacefully, but stay off the busy streets so people can get where they need to go." What do you say?
Well, first of all, just to clarify that this year, like every other year, we will be marching in solidarity with the May 1st Action Coalition, which has decided the route. I think the corporate media, which tends to sensationalize everything, they ascribe...
Does that include KUOW?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But I think that, you know, through the sensationalizing of the corporate media, I think a false portrayal of how much I individually decide is given. In reality, this is a collective, democratic, united movement. And collectively, we have decided this march route, and the march route does not include any freeways.
Okay, no freeways. Some busy streets, I assume that's the point.
Yes, the busy streets are the point. And I think that ultimately, you know, people who are legitimately worried about emergency vehicles and all of that is completely legitimate. And I worry about that too. But I also worry, and our movement also worries about the disruption that is caused to ordinary families when their parents are taken away into detention. Imagine what would happen if those of you who are listening and you have little children, this is real. Imagine if your child was left bereft of your parenthood because you were seized by ICE and put in a detention cell and there was no way for the family to contact you. This is the real life situation that many of our sisters and brothers right here in Seattle are facing. I think it's our moral and political duty to stand with them in peaceful rallies and march nonviolently but firmly against the violence of ICE raids.
Yes, we already have disruption, you're saying. And on our Facebook page, Chris writes, "Wow, pretty clear where the bourgeois white liberals in Seattle stand. Don't inconvenience them or they're not with you. Pitiful." Is that fair? You find that in Seattle?
I understand where the sentiment is coming from. I think that the most effective way to build for nonviolent civil disobedience and mass resistance, which I believe we need in general, we need to build for a summer of resistance against Trump.
A summer of resistance.
I don't think May 1st should be seen as the end of anything. I think it's the beginning of a summer of resistance. But that resistance is going to be effective if it is peaceful, nonviolent, and brings more and more into the movement. And that's why we're talking about immigrant rights, LGBTQ rights, women's rights, workers' rights. We all stand on it, stand for those rights. So let's march in a united manner and let's build a strong movement against Trump and the billionaire class.
Before we leave the topic of highways, we do have the state patrol captain, Ron Mead, saying, he said a freeway protest. You said it's not about freeways, but the principle is the same. I think he said it's dangerous and irresponsible to suggest it. And I want to ask you, Councilmember Shamasawant, when you have officers try, and I know you don't control, you don't wave your wand and make everything happen, as you're saying, but when you have officers trying to keep demonstrators from getting to highways or busy streets, does that set up a potentially violent clash? People do listen to you. What do you want to tell them about what they tactics?
I think our message, both for tactics and the goals for May Day, is a message of empowerment and a message of unity. We do need thousands, tens of thousands of people in Seattle to be out on May Day. And the best way, actually, to prevent any kind of violence is for the nonviolent movement to be large and loud and peaceful. So that's why if you're listening and you're inspired by the fight, the need to fight for immigrant sisters and brothers and to fight for workers and to fight for yourself, for your rights against Trump and the billionaire class, and I would encourage everybody to be out there. I would say I'm not surprised by the statements made by the authorities, including the Washington State Patrol and the Seattle Police Department. That's what they do. Their job is to repress protests. I don't condone that job. I think that it's really quite bad that they are doing this.
They're trying to keep people safe as well, not just to suppress people's voices.
If we're talking about safety, and if you're talking about eliminating disruptions, then we can't do that artificially by staying home. The real disruption, as I said, is happening because Amazon security workers don't have prayer rights. The Muslim workers don't have prayer rights. The real disruption and violence is ICE raids and families being ripped apart. The real violence of our society is the president dropping bombs on Syria and Afghanistan. The real violence is such a wealthy country not
even in
having,
retaliation for a nerve gas attack. Well, I didn't think we'd get to Syria.
I'm saying that there is a lot of violence in our society, but in order to fight against that violence, we do need peaceful demonstrations, mm-hmm. but we can't just do it quietly without disrupting business as usual. Disrupting business as usual in a peaceful and nonviolent manner is what history has shown works. You know, we would not have any black rights, women rights, rights for immigrants, rights for workers, unless working people were willing to disrupt the profit-making business as usual. I don't anticipate that all of this is going to be achieved on May Day. That's why I would see May Day and May 1st as a beginning of an empowered and peaceful resistance.
Examples of other resistance that you're interested in, students organizing walkouts in their schools, actions in the workplace. What do you want workers to do?
As far as possible, if working people are able to take the day off, call in sick, or take an extended lunch hour, join the protest rally, and come out and talk to us, I think that would be great. I know that in other cities like Los Angeles and the Bay Area, I know that there's going to be much larger protests, and not just protests, but strike actions. Just to give a concrete example, 340,000 food workers and custodial workers in California have all pledged to go out on strike. Their unions are going out on strike. And so we will see big actions nationwide. Seattle may not be the biggest, but Seattle workers need to be in solidarity with all workers.
We just have a minute left, Council Member. Seattle City workers can take May Day off for a reason of conscience, but unpaid, correct?
Yes, and in fact, that's a state law. The state law says that all public employees can take 2 days off every year for reasons of religion or reasons of conscience. And our point was, well, what more of a reason of conscience is there than fighting against Trump?
Final question, Councilmember Sawant, will you run for mayor?
I don't have any plans as of now to run for mayor.
Why not?
Because I think that the question of building movements is not simply tied to what I personally do in terms of running for office. My job right now is to use my city council position to the utmost.
But you could use the mayoral position.
Absolutely. The mayoral position should also be used. In fact, I think that it is not enough for our movement that we just talk about Shyama Sawant having been elected as a socialist. What we need is a number of candidates running through the movement that who, when elected, will remain accountable to the movement, as I have. And that is why, ultimately, the question is not of any individual person running or not running. The question is, how are we going to build our grassroots movement together? And that's not just about me. Every person who is listening to this show, if you feel a sense of responsibility to build a decent society, you need to join our movement.
Definitely not running for mayor.
I'm definitely not running for mayor.
Okay. You say that every time you're on KOW, by the way. I want to point out that it's not about you. It's about you're turning it back to someone listening to you right now. It's about you. Yeah. Right?
It's about everybody who's listening, yes.
Okay. Just the beginning, says Seattle City Council member Shyama Sawant, tens of thousands of people on the street on Monday, May Day. Yes, she's asking for that. But beyond that, a summer of resistance. And who knows what more. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much.
Seattle City Council member Shyama Sawant, a good May Day to you, a good, safe, and productive and inspiring May Day to everyone.
And happy May Day to you all.
Thank you. It's The Record. This is KOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. Here is the latest in the fight over public lands in western states. President Trump has signed an executive order to review all national monuments created in the last 20 years. Trump says he wants to end another egregious use of government power. That could mean eliminating or resizing some national monuments. And the review list might include two national monuments in Washington state. Here to tell you what's happening is New York Times Seattle Bureau Chief Kirk Johnson. Kirk, welcome back to KUOW.
Thanks, Bill. Welcome.
Those two protected areas in Washington that could be reviewed are the San Juan Islands National Monument and the Hanford Reach along the Columbia River in eastern Washington. How likely is it that either of these monuments would be affected by Trump's executive order?
Well, I think there's a lot of uncertainty because of the wording of the order, which gives all kinds of latitude about the size of monuments, but also how much public input went into their creation. So on the surface, a lot of this looks like it's really aimed at the big controversial one that's out there in Utah, Bears Ears.
Why is that so controversial?
Partly because the Utah congressional delegation and the political establishment there has taken great issue with it and made it a campaign that they say was a government overreach at the last minute by the Obama administration.
Do we have that kind of controversy in Washington over either Hanford Reach or the San Juan Islands National Monument?
Definitely not within the political structure at all. And I think these two monuments are also very different than Bears Ears or the other big controversial one that still hangs over in Utah, the Escalante staircase. Which was created by Clinton in his final years. Hanford is really a fascinating piece of frozen natural history along the banks of the Columbia, created as it is by the Hanford nuclear facility, which kind of created a boundary around it that froze it in place starting in 1943. So it's not a place like Southern Utah that has been sort of coveted by oil or gas or coal or anything like that. So it does not seem to be in anybody's sights at this moment.
Okay. Hanford Reach and San Juan Islands National Monument, probably safe, it sounds like. Right?
Again, if they want to tease out the language of this, they could probably go after individual ones, but at this moment, it seems like they'd be in the background.
How's the president deciding which monuments get reviewed and which don't? Do you know?
The date is starting in 1996, anything uh-huh. after that, and of a certain size, 100,000 acres or larger. So it really takes in the Clinton and Obama monuments. The Antiquities Act, which is the heart of this, which was created in the Teddy Roosevelt years in 1906, has been used by almost every president. The only three that made no designations of monuments at all were Nixon, Reagan, and the first Bush. But it has really become a tool of preservation by Clinton and Obama, and I think that's sort of the window that the Trump administration is kind of trying to pry open.
Trump thinks they overreached using this century-old Antiquities Act?
That's the tone, and that is certainly the message that the Utah congressional delegation and the legislature has hit over and over again, that it's too big, it is created with an agenda that is not the state's agenda, that it will hurt the economy, and so on and so on.
Does Trump have the power to undo a national monument created by a past president?
There's where we say hello, lawyers, I think. There is a lot of uncertainty and untested court questions. No president has ever rescinded a national monument. Presidents and Congress have both adjusted boundaries in the past, but courts never challenged it. So it's a very vague concept about how big they should be and who exactly, whether there is a power in the act to, especially to rescind it. I mean, the great example of the weird unquestioned question of size was, again, back to Teddy Roosevelt. He designated the Grand Canyon as a national monument before National Park Days, and it was a big space. And he said, well, it has to be big to protect a big thing. And nobody could argue that that was wrong.
So. Okay, so we're talking about politics and overreach. Is there an economic argument? What's the best argument for eliminating or resizing some national monuments?
The argument that gets made especially in Utah, but also in the big marine monuments that were created and expanded by George W. Bush and then by Obama in the Pacific. Fishing was infringed on. It was argued there was a court case challenge there. In Utah, the Escalante staircase had a big coal mine that was proposed in those lands that became impossible after monument designation. And with the Bears Ears, there is a oil or gas exploration argument. On the other hand, it's really easy to find people on the boundaries of many of these monuments, including Utah, who say, you know, that Escalante was the best thing that ever happened for their economies and tourism. And
Yeah. Fishing, coal, resources. Here we get back to the larger battle. We've been talking about this over and over, the, you know, how to use public lands in the West and private versus public uses. And it's just one of the things that Kirk Johnson is going to keep on covering as the Seattle bureau chief of the New York Times. And in this case, it's President Trump reviewing national monuments created in the last 20 years. Thanks for filling us in on it.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill.
And by the way, it sounds like your local national monuments, the ones in the last 20 years, Hanford Reach, the one in the San Juan Islands, safe for now, probably.
Probably.
Probably. We'll watch.
That's the key word, yeah.
Thanks, Kirk.
Thank you.
KUOW is the record. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. Good to have you along. I'm Bill Radke.
It still makes me tear up every time I remember this. I was lucky to know from a very young age that I was different from other girls and that I was not going to be like my sisters, attracted to boys, but I didn't have the language to describe what I was or who I was.
Jackie Lorenzar grew up in Mexico City in the 80s in a conservative, powerful family. When Jackie was in her early teens, her parents found out she was gay, and they kicked her out. But Jackie was lucky. She had friends who helped her, got her jobs playing in bands.
So one thing led to another, and all of a sudden I met a man, Alejandro Cervantes, who was an artist. He was the first openly gay man to run for office in Mexico City.
Alejandro won that election, but then started to get death threats. A week later, he was found beaten, close to death. That's when Jackie and her friends, other gay and lesbian activists, realized they were in danger too. So Jackie made plans to go into hiding. She's going to tell you her story. I warn you, it gets harrowing about 4 minutes in, hard to listen to, and probably not appropriate for kids. Okay, so Jackie feels she's in danger in Mexico City, and she has what she calls a crazy idea.
I had this crazy idea of going to say goodbye to my mother. So I went to visit her, and it wasn't that trip that I didn't know the police were watching the place where we lived. So I got arrested before I got to my parents' house. And I was taken to a place, I still don't know where it was, but I think I was there for about 3 or 4 days, and my father was a member of the government at that time, and he told me that the government had a list of my friends, and that if anything happened, he was not gonna intervene or do anything because they were bad people. Because, you know, we never got along, so I was like, oh, this is another one of his crazy things. But he was right. I mean, he told me the truth, and I didn't find out until many years later when I applied for asylum. At my interview, the immigration officer actually had a list of all the LGBTQ activists that had been disappeared or murdered during a 3-year period. And I knew all of them.
Did you fear for your life?
Yes. Yes.
So then when you were in your early 20s, I think this was in the mid-90s, you decided you needed to leave Mexico. You got together some money, headed to the airport, and how did you end up in Seattle?
Well, we asked the person at the airport how far I could go with the money that I had. And she said, Seattle. And I was like, where is that? And she just told me, have you heard of Nirvana? And I was like, oh, yeah.
Nirvana.
Love Nirvana. And she said, like, there. And I was, okay, let's go to Seattle. So I ended up here with $20 and my guitar. And that was it. Never look back.
And when you got here, you applied for asylum.
Not right away, because as you can imagine, I was really afraid and traumatized by all the things that have happened. So I really didn't want anybody to know who I was or how I got here. And so it took about a year for me to gather the courage to tell the attorney, okay, submit my application.
So this would have been a first for someone to come from Mexico and apply for asylum saying, I'm being persecuted for my sexual orientation in my home country. What was that whole experience like, trying to be that first?
Well, it was nerve-wracking and very scary because I had never told what had happened to me to anybody. And so the person I worked with in my case was amazing because she really helped me to kind of tell the story. I had nightmares. I later actually was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder because of the torture. And I still, to this day, deal with the sequels of that. Like, I had all sorts of medical issues because of that.
May I ask you how you were tortured? Can you talk about that?
I can talk about it. It's kind of traumatic, so people who are listening, just beware. Mm-hmm. I got electric shocks on my genitals for 3 days, and I was raped. As a result of that, I had to have a total hysterectomy when I was in my late 20s. They would put a plastic bag on my head with a chili pepper. And so I had, you know, when I couldn't breathe, I would breathe it in and it will burn and burn my eyes. So my nose will start bleeding and you feel like you're choking. So for many, many years, when I felt stress, I would start feeling that feeling that I couldn't breathe. I would start feeling that I was choking. And I would lose my voice for days because of my body remembering those feelings. So I couldn't talk. And that was part of the difficulty in telling my story, was that, you know, I would get to that point and I couldn't talk. And she was like, what's happening? What's going on? And I just couldn't say anything else. So I had to wait 3 days, 4 days for me to kind of feel safe again to kind of retell it. But it took a lot for me to really recount everything that happened to me. And after that point, I realized if it was hard for me that I had, you know, the luck to have an attorney that was very understanding, very knowledgeable, and people who were helping me. It just hit me that for people who don't have that, it must seem impossible. So from that day on, I decided that I wanted to help other people like me to find safety.
Do you remember when you found out that you had been granted asylum?
It's a horrible day in American history. It was September 11, 2001. And I remember watching the news and seeing the towers falling and opening a letter and reading, you have been granted asylum to the United States. And I didn't know if I should cry or be happy, or like, it was a crazy day. And the thing that I was most worried about is the repercussions on immigrants and refugees like me.
So you were in Seattle.
Yeah.
You were working with the LGBT community here, mm-hmm. with the city, with different organizations.
Yeah.
And then something happened just a couple of years ago that you felt that you had prepared your entire life for.
Yeah.
What happened?
I got a call from Anne McGettigan, who's the director of an organization called Seattle Council in Service. They've been providing mental health services for the LGBT community for more than 45 years. They're one of the first organizations to do that in the world. And I felt very grateful to them, because when I first arrived here, somebody referred me to them. And it was thanks to them that I was able to get help to deal with the post-traumatic stress disorder and the torture. They actually referred me to a psychiatrist at UW that worked with me for many years. So I always thought, one day I'm going to do something for them. But, you know, I never had enough money to be a donor. So when she called me and said, hey, we got a grant to start a program for LGBTQ immigrants, refugees, and undocumented, and help them to get mental health services, would you be willing to help us design the program? And I was like, yes, of course. And so I told them, let's ask if we can use the money to do a survey and gather data from people who are here in King County and find out what are their needs and how we can really help. And so this idea of creating a survey was born.
But how difficult must it have been to get people who had been through this experience to talk about it?
It was really hard. And actually, I was telling somebody that I actually failed, because my idea was to interview 100 people. And I was able only to interview 52. So
the rest didn't even want to do an interview.
No, and it was, I think it's to this day, one of the hardest things that I've ever done, because it made me realize how safe I felt now, like after all this time, that I was in a very different place, but also made me realize that things hadn't changed that much in other parts of the world. And I was sitting with people that had come from Africa, from the Arab countries, telling me the same things that I had gone through. I was sitting there going, wow, here I am, you know, thinking these folks are just going to come and tell me, when I couldn't do that. So we redesigned the whole process of the survey to address confidentiality in a very, very special way. Because a lot of the folks that I interviewed in the beginning, five of them told me that it was crucial that nobody could identify them or their families back home. Because for a lot of their families being related to somebody in the LGBT community could mean death or life in prison. So they asked me to remove any kind of identification, name, phone numbers. So what we did was we actually created a survey in a laptop that was only used for that. And it was amazing. Once we did that, one person referred me to another person and that person to another person. And the one thing that really struck me was the hope that we all had. Like, even though we had been through horrible things, we had this hope that now we had a chance at life. And that was amazing.
I'm amazed that these people even could tell you a story like that and put words to their experiences. Was that what else was the biggest challenge in collecting this data, these human stories?
Well, the other big challenge was, and this was another realization that I had while talking to people, is that in a lot of our countries, the language doesn't have the words to describe who we are. And in the United States, we've been having for the last 15 years this conversation about gender equity, gender expression, sexual orientation, sexual preference, and the whole continuum within that. That has not happened in a lot of other countries. And so people here have words to describe their experience in loving relationships and sexual attractions or how they express their gender that in other countries or other cultures is not the case. Like I learned, for example, that in Arabic, there is no word for gay. And there are some insults that refer to gay people or transgender people, but they wouldn't use them because they're offensive. So how then do you describe your experience? How do you talk about the feelings that you have in a way that you don't get lost in that world of hate? So I had all these conversations with them, and we created a glossary of terms of words that are used here in the United States. And we will talk about them first and just say, so these are some of the things that are used here to describe this, 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 and that. But you can define yourself whatever way you want to. But this is just a point of reference. And that helped a lot. And still there were people that had a lot of difficulty relating because, for example, in Africa, this man from Uganda told me that to say I'm a gay man had a connotation that he would align politically with American politics and an American agenda. And that was not him. So he said, I love men, but I am not gay.
Wow. To not even have words for yourself that aren't soaked in hate or partisanship, that's profound.
It is. It is. And that's what made me realize how important it is to have mental health services for folks, because you need somebody that is trained on this therapeutic processes to really help you unfold all of that and really find that piece of you that's still pure, where you can find love for yourself, where you can find acceptance. And so we need to do the research, we need to gather the data, we need to tell our stories. And we need to be courageous and say, I'm here and I matter and I'm going to work to make my life worth something, right? Because we only have one life. And if we don't use it to make the world better, then, you know, I don't know why we're here for.
I want to thank Jackie Lorenzar, who's now an election supervisor for King County Elections. She has worked as the LGBTQ immigrant and refugee outreach specialist for the Seattle Counseling Service, where she ran a survey of Seattle's LGBTQ refugees and immigrants. She still gets calls from places like Iran and China from people who want to use what Seattle Counseling Service has learned to design their own mental health programs for LGBTQ people. This is KUOW's The Record. Now, one of the many, many remarkable things Jackie just told you was that she found out she had gotten asylum in the United States on September 11th, 2001. Well, KUOW happens to have a new podcast that tells a story you don't know from a day we all remember. The podcast is called How's Your Day? For example, most people remember April 19th, 1995 for the deadly Oklahoma City bombing. But for Captain Brian Udell, that day holds a completely different significance. He was flying a fighter jet over the Atlantic Ocean at the speed of sound when suddenly his plane had a catastrophic failure. Captain Udell recounts that day in this excerpt from the podcast.
It's almost surreal. I mean, the first time I flew a Strike Eagle, it was you're anxious, you're excited, you know, you're focused. You want to do everything right. You are amazed at how big the airplane actually is, and you're really amazed at how much power it has. Every airplane that you encounter has an ejection system. The reason that they don't replicate an actual ejection, obviously, is the potential for injury or death is pretty high. The amount of G-forces that are applied to the spine and back under a real ejection, obviously it could hurt you. And so they don't want to hurt you, they want to train you. So the first time that you pull the handles in an emergency situation to leave an aircraft is the first time that you've actually done it.
In downtown Oklahoma City, we know this is making national news across the United States. People are wondering and calling into Oklahoma to see if their family members and loved ones.
Talking through this as we get information on injuries and exactly where this explosion took place.
So a major sense of a heightened alert.
The weather out over the water that night was kind of a hazy type thing, so there was no discernible horizon out there. It was pitch black. There was no moon, no stars. It's a different sensation. You can be upside down and feel like you're right side up. You can be going straight up and be going straight down. And that's basically what happened that night. It was out off the coast of North Carolina. I went into a right-hand turn at 24,000 feet and 400 knots. I was listening to that airplane, and that airplane was talking to me. What I was hearing, what I was seeing, made absolutely no sense. I bring up an attitude indicator that gives me that same information, but it's formatted differently. I look down at that, and that had me pointed straight at the water. And it was at that point in time, I realized that that's it, we've got to get out. And I commanded the ejection, I got in a body position, and I pulled the ejection handles.
Good evening. It was the deadliest terror attack aimed right at the heart of America. A car bomb today all but demolished a U.S. government building in downtown Oklahoma City.
There are four of the names, and that way it will tell you exactly where you need to go and what kind of the latest information. There again, you see people walking around. These people are dazed. There were Tom Caniglione was talking about the emotional fallout from this. People just don't know.
That was an excerpt from KUOW's new podcast, How's Your Day? To hear about the rest of Captain Udell's story, just go to kuow.org/podcast. We're going to be talking about a lower stakes kind of air travel later this afternoon. United Airlines has come out and said it's going to reduce the overbooking of flights and boost the amount of compensation they offer to get you to give up your seat. This is great news to that small band of hardy travelers who actually want to get bumped. They try to get bumped, and they've got some interesting strategies that you'll hear about later today on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW's The Record continues. I'm Bill Radke. This week, President Trump said he wants to cut taxes on corporate income. That tax cut would benefit President Trump personally, because it would lower taxes on his real estate business. Is that a conflict of interest? NPR has formed a team to track conflicts of interest in the Trump administration. And leading that team is NPR business editor Marilyn Geewax. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Marilyn, starting with taxes, this is not the president's private tax cut. Trump says this would benefit a lot of job creators, and they'll hire more workers and everyone benefits. Is there something wrong with that?
Well, it would be nice to know just exactly how it would benefit his own holdings. So let's say he has shaped these laws so that they are particularly favorable to people in real estate. Well, we don't really know that because we don't know exactly where is his money coming from. We know he has some real estate, but is that the primary source of his income? What else might he benefit from? There are lots of questions about just how much he takes advantage of various loopholes. What is the impact of the alternative minimum tax on him?
And he could show us all that if he wanted to?
As every other president has in the modern era, presidents always reveal their taxes so that you can look at how they're shaping public policy and see how that might affect their private holdings. But in this case, since we have nothing to measure it against, your imagination can run wild. I mean, maybe this is absolutely the best public policy there could be, but without knowing how it affects him personally, you know, people have suspicions that he may be doing this for his own benefit, tailoring and all the laws to help himself. So it does create a problem. It creates doubts in the public's mind where you really don't need that. All he has to do is release his taxes.
This president has so many potential conflicts of interest. Will you remind us of just a top few?
Well, there are lots of problems on the foreign side. Let's just take a few. He has more than 500 different business interests based on the disclosure form that he filed last May when he was running for office. And many of those businesses are overseas. And for example, he himself has said on tape previously back in December of 2015, he was doing an interview and he said he has a conflict of interest because he has big operations in Istanbul. And he wanted to get along well with Turkey because he has this really large project there. Well, recently, he called the leader of Turkey to congratulate him on an election victory. And there are many people who wonder if he made that unusual endorsement of Erdogan, the head of Turkey, because he wants to stay in the good graces of the government and make sure that his businesses in Istanbul are profitable. Or did he do it because it's in the best interests of U.S. public policy? We don't know because he has not divested himself. He hasn't sold off that property. There's also questions about, for example, in the Philippines. He also has operations in Manila. And as luck would have it, the government in the Philippines has appointed Trump's business partner as the U.S. envoy. Again, you know, you just don't know. Is he being friendly to the government in the Philippines and Turkey and lots of other places because he has businesses there and wants to do business? Or is it because it's in the best interest of the American people? Those foreign holdings create a lot of questions.
What would be a worst case scenario?
Well, that in fact he is supportive of these authoritarian leaders, not because it brings about world peace, but because it makes it easier for his family to personally profit from their operations there. I'm not saying that they are.
The U.S. has supported a lot of nasty people for a lot of reasons, so I'm wondering what's the, with this potential conflict of interest, let's say the Istanbul with Erdogan, what's the worst case scenario if Americans let that slide?
I mean, the ethics experts would say that if he took all of these holdings of his and put them in a blind trust, a truly blind trust, not run by his sons as they are now, that would take away these concerns about is he doing it for personal enrichment. But as long as you have that gray area where you don't know why is he doing this, what are his personal motivations, it creates questions not just in the public's mind in the United States, but our allies wonder as well, is he doing these things because it's good foreign policy, or is he doing it because he wants his children to get richer?
So far what we know is not damage, it's question marks.
Right.
It's
right.
We don't know. All presidents have conflicts of interest. If they didn't before they got to the White House, then they know that they can enrich themselves once they leave. Bill Clinton served knowing that Wall Street money was awaiting him and his wife. How much more conflicted is Trump than usual?
Right. All presidents, when they leave office, I mean, they all do make money. I mean, there's never,
And they know that when they're in office. Right.
I mean, it's always the question after presidents leave that who do they give speeches to? But What was very different about the Trump situation is he came into this with all of these, as I say, hundreds of businesses, and they're not public corporations. These are not things that file with the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. There aren't public documents to explain what his business holdings are. These are all privately held within the Trump organization. And that makes it very different. They're very secretive about their businesses. We don't know much at all, and we certainly know almost nothing about what debts, who does he owe money to. Now, other presidents in the past, what they've done with their wealth, and keep in mind, many presidents, you know, are pretty wealthy, but they take their holdings and sell them and turn the money over to a professional manager who keeps the money and invests in things like U.S. Treasury securities, that sort of thing. And then at the end of their term, they get their money back, and then they're free to go off and earn whatever the money they want from giving speeches. But there was the case of Jimmy Carter back in the 70s when people were distraught because he had a peanut farm, and people were worried that he was shaping peanut policy to help his own farm. But he didn't want to give up his family business, so he took the entire peanut operation and turned it over to a professional management in a blind trust. And he really didn't know if the person had sold it off or what. I mean, it wasn't, he just sequestered himself from that operation. So Trump has not done that at all. What he has done is put the operations, all of his holdings, into a trust. It's a revocable trust or revocable. He can revoke it at any time. He can take money out of it at any time. The sole beneficiary is Donald J. Trump, and it is run by his sons. So ethics experts say that is the very definition of not doing what you're supposed to do. It's completely transparent, and he's the sole beneficiary of it. So it's very different.
We're talking with NPR's Marilyn Giewax, who heads an NPR team tracking the many conflicts of interest of President Trump. Marilyn, do you know what American voters think of Trump and his family benefiting from his presidency? Is there reliable polling on that?
For the most part, just as a general rule, Americans don't get particularly upset about ethics. There's sort of a sense that, oh, everybody does it. And, you know, so far, this is still pretty new into the administration. Obviously, we're only a couple of months in. And so far, it's kind of predictable along party lines. Democrats are much more concerned about it than Republicans are. But overall, this tends not to be a topic that rises to the top of people's minds. But you know, over time, it can be corrosive. Right now, people are focused on things like jobs and the economy and the taxes and the health care, and those kinds of topics are front and center. But over time, if people see that the Trump children in particular are enriching themselves, eventually that may have some impact.
So if the public is not yet pushing Trump on his conflicts of interest, is there any evidence Trump is reacting to media scrutiny like yours?
So far, they really have not responded in a way that would suggest they care particularly.
How do you feel about that? Are you making a difference, Marilyn?
Well, I mean, for example, let me just give you a couple of examples of things. One major concern that we've had in Washington, D.C. is the hotel that Trump owns there. It's just blocks from the White House. It's in the old post office building. That's a historic building that's owned by the taxpayers. And back in 2013, Trump got the lease to run a hotel inside of it. Well, 2013 is a long time ago. That was long before he was running for office. But now that he's the president, it's very clear in Washington that there's a lot of not explicit pressure, but internal pressure where lobbyists and foreign governments feel like they have to go to that hotel to make a good impression on the president.
The president is the tenant and the landlord, in effect.
He's both the tenant and the landlord, and it's just blocks from the White House. So this hotel, a lot of people say, wait a minute, why are these foreign organizations, for example, there's going to be a Turkish Day celebration coming up, and the Kuwait National Day celebration was held at the hotel. And people question whether or not these people are steering money to the Trump family by choosing to have their expensive events at this hotel. Allow me to point out the cheapest cocktail you can get there is $24. So it's a pretty pricey hotel, very high end, very beautiful. And the president goes there to have dinner. So that brings media attention. People are they paying money to be in the same room with the president? Is that why they're doing things there? He just had dinner there the other week on a Saturday night with his wife. So, okay, there are all these questions about the ethics of that hotel, and we've pointed it out 1,000 times. So what's the latest twist in the story? His sons are scouting for a second location to open a second hotel in D.C.
Final question. When Trump took office, some people said he's going to get impeached. He'll get tripped up by his rule violations. Is there any sign that Trump will get in serious trouble over his conflicts of interest? Or do you have any guesses around that?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people watching very carefully for what happens next. But so far, to have an impeachment, you would have to have Congress involved. That is, the House has to initiate investigations and the House has to do something. Well, the House Oversight Committee so far has expressed fundamentally no interest in this topic. So you would have to have something happen that really caused enough outrage that would push Republicans on the House Oversight Committee to start really investigating some scandal or other that would involve Turkey or Russia or something like that, that will finally push Republicans in the House to investigate. But right now, everything's kind of a lot of smoke, not necessarily fire. But at this point, the House is not acting, so there's no glimmer of any impeachment sort of activity because it's just too premature. And of course, maybe nothing will come of it. I mean, as the president points out, people knew that he was a wealthy businessman. They elected him. So his position is that in the court of public opinion, he won. The voters supported him. And that's kind of where the House Republicans are coming from.
Okay. So as you said, a lot of smoke. Marilyn G. Wax is breathing that smoke for you. She is heading NPR's team tracking the conflicts of interest of this presidency. Marilyn, thanks for telling us about it.
Oh, you're welcome.
There is another figure close to President Trump who inspires a lot of questions, a lot of unanswered questions, and that is former campaign manager Paul Manafort. Why do his business dealings continue to stir up so much interest, and who is he, really? You'll hear that later today, and you'll learn who likes President Trump's tough stance on trade with Canada and who does not, and so much more on KUOW's All Things Considered. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks a lot for tuning into The Record. We're live tweeting at KUOW, and join us again tomorrow for The Record.